Welcome to Gut Reactions, a podcast about your guts and why they're so important, presented by the New Zealand Gut Foundation and hosted by me, Tim Batt. Since its inception, the Gut Foundation Trust has raised over $1 million for combating gut diseases, including funding large research programs, cutting-edge equipment, and grassroots patient support groups. Today, I get to chat to Dr. Rachel Purcell, who is a research fellow with Otago University's Department of Surgery with a background in molecular biology and cancer genetics. Her research is centered around the molecular mechanisms of pathogenic bacteria and colorectal carcinogenesis. Rachel, hello.
Hi, Tim.
How did I go with the pronunciation of those
Latin words? Yeah, pretty good, actually.
That I stole from your bio. So
yeah, it's pretty old bio.
Maybe maybe it would be useful then if you introduce us to who you are and what you're doing at the moment.
Okay, yeah. Well, I work in the Department of Surgery, but I'm not a surgeon, not a clinician. So I'm purely research based. My background is in molecular biology, as you say, but also in microbiology. So I did a master's degree in micro way back, and then I got into more cancer biology, but I always kept an eye on the whole microbiology field as it was evolving. And it was really great when the whole microbiome thing just kind of exploded about 10 years ago or so, because that really brought together both streams of what I was really interested in, cancer biology and the microbes. Yeah, so that's really what I've been working on ever since.
As we get into this, let's assume that I'm an idiot. Let's just say that for the sake of argument and discussion.
Okay.
So let's get some definitions. First of all, microbiology in a nutshell is, how would you describe it?
Basically, it's studying anything that you need to look at under a microscope. So bacteria, fungi, viruses, anything like that.
And you're studying these tiny little organisms' relationship to cancer? Is that what carcinogenesis is?
Yeah, carcinogenesis is the process of getting cancer, basically, of how our cells turn bad and turn on ourselves and form a tumor. So it's that whole process.
My understanding of cancer is that it's just any cell that goes a bit weird with its wiring and starts replicating and taking over healthy cells. Is that
more or less? That's right, Tim. Yeah, it's when cells go rogue. Yeah, and they have uncontrolled growth, and then they form what we know as tumors. And then they can get out of hand and spread to other parts of the body.
Gotcha. And you mentioned moments ago that there has been this explosion in a field of expertise known as the study of the microbiome. What is that?
Oh, the microbiome. I mean, everyone's probably heard about it now.
It's become really surprised. Mainstream. See, you live in this world, but outside bubble.
Oh, no, it's all over the place now. Well, the microbiome is basically all the microbes that live in a particular environment and all their genetic material. So it's kind of like a niche area of microbes and how they interact with that particular environment. So we're not just looking at one microbe or bacteria that causes a disease. We're looking at a whole range of them that interact together and have different functions and live in a particular niche, and that's a microbiome.
So I kind of think of like a forest in my head that exists in our bodies and our gut. So there's different trees, and down below the canopy there's like different ferns and there's little animals running around in there. So there's a whole diversity of life. Is it a similar sort of thing, but obviously smaller?
That's a really, really good analogy, Tim. And it's one I use myself sometimes as well to describe the diversity and what happens when we lose diversity. Another way of looking at it maybe is like when we talk about the human microbiome, it's like our own personal army. You know, so you've got your cavalry and your infantry and, you know, all your little soldiers fighting on your behalf. Yeah.
Let's talk about what the army's doing. So what are all of these microorganisms that make up our microbiome? What are they doing?
Well, we have different microbiomes in all different body locations. So I'm mainly interested in the gut microbiome, because that, as well as influencing our gut and everything around the gut, it influences, you know, all our systems in our body. And we're coming to realize that more and more, the more research that's been done. So in terms of the gut microbiome, it's got a huge range of really important roles. So one of the most important is probably in immunity. So it kind of teaches our immune system. If we don't have a microbiome from birth, And we know this from animal studies, we don't actually develop a proper immune system. So it trains our immune system to recognize what's a stealth, and so it doesn't attack it, and what's a pathogen that it should attack. And then it also protects our guts really from pathogens by outcompeting them for nutrients. So that's one of the big roles it has as well. So just say we ingest something that's, you know, pathogenic, maybe in food that's, you know, would normally give you food poisoning.
When you say pathogenic, so I'm thinking like a dodgy bit of chicken, maybe.
Yeah, a dodgy bit of chicken with a bit of campylobacter in it, and it gets into your gut. But if you've got a really healthy gut, usually that campylobacter just can't get a hold. It can't get enough nutrients, and it can't colonize, it can't grow. So basically, you're outcompeted by your healthy microbiome. It's got a few other really important roles as well in vitamin synthesis and breaking down toxic products from our food, basically. Yeah, so lots of really, really important roles there.
Yeah, it sounds pretty crucial. Yeah. All these little jobs are almost like they constitute what keep us alive in many ways,
exactly.
Breaking down nutrients and making sure baddies don't take over the bits that we need to function. So we get taught as kids, I got taught as a child, that germs are bad. You know, we've just had COVID, so everyone's encouraged to scrub their hands all the time and get alcohol sanitizer on there to kill all the germs. It seems like the answer is yes, based on what you've just said, but like, is that an unuseful way to think about the microorganisms that are around us, both on our body and in the world that we're in?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think we're kind of at almost a tipping point with our microbiome and disease, and we really need to re-educate people, I think, about the microbiome and about our biology and, you know, what we're doing to ourselves that may be causing disease. Because like you say, with COVID, you really see everybody's dousing themselves in hand sanitizer. But, you know, I mean, which is fine. In certain situations, you really got to do that. You know, if it's in the community or, you know, say post-earthquake when you've got, you know, breakdown in your water systems, situations like that. But apart from that, we really should just be washing our hands with soap and water, because that does get rid of the pathogens, but it doesn't strip away our good microbiome that's actually defending us from those pathogens.
So soap is actually pretty effective of getting rid of just
soap and water is great.
Surface, you know, stuff.
That's the way to go. But I think, you know, we're bombarded in the media as well by, you know, products that claim to get rid of 99.9% of germs. And I mean, I guess without education, you kind of think, God, maybe I should be doing that. Everything should be, you know, sterile in my house. I should be able to perform surgery on the floor of my kitchen. But, you know,
that is the perception because of these marketing products, right? That, you know, this kitchen spray, it kills, as you say, like 99.99% of all germs. It's like, oh, crap, I guess germs are terrible then, because obviously this thing's been designed to wipe all of them out.
I mean, even the word germ, it's, you know, it's not a good word.
I don't even really know what it means. Like,
it doesn't really mean anything.
It's not a scientific word?
No, it's not. It's not. It's just used to make you, I guess, make you feel guilty and buy these products and clean your kitchen more.
Because as you sort of touched on before, there's lots of varieties of these different microorganisms, these germs, if you will. But in terms of the classification, what did you go through? There's fungi.
Yeah, fungi, bacteria, which I mainly work in, viruses, archaea. So, I mean, we're usually talking about viruses and bacteria, I guess, most of the time. But yeah, most of those are actually not harmful. They're beneficial to us. So we've got to be a little bit careful about what we do. I think, like, a lot has changed in the last 100 years. You know, 100 years ago, most people died of infection. You know, so infectious disease was our big killer, right? And then we discovered antibiotics and antiseptics, you know, and that really changed everything. But then the pendulum swung so far, and now we've kind of got that under control in, well, the Western world anyway. But now we're seeing this massive increase in non-infectious diseases like asthma, allergies, inflammatory diseases, and cancer. And, you know, there is a link there somewhere, and we're starting to really understand how maybe, you know, the way we act is actually causing this to some degree.
Well, let's get into that. What is the current science suggesting is happening?
Well, I think really the main kind of theories are that we're limiting our microbial exposure in young, you know, when we're babies, when we're very young, and when we really need that to develop our immune systems. And then later in life, when we are, you know, we come across these, I guess we call them immune assaults, our body just turns on itself. You know, so a lot of inflammatory diseases are on the rise, you know, inflammatory related things like ulcerative colitis and even diverticular disease, which used to be really, you know, disease of old people. And it's on the increase in young people, and particularly in places like New Zealand and a lot of Western countries. And
is the suggestion that we have basically cleaned our lives up so much and sanitized to the point where we're not getting exposure to these germs that actually inform our body how to react to things?
It's not just what we do ourselves. I mean, I think one of the biggest drivers of this has been the overuse of antibiotics. And that's really something I think as health systems are going to have to look at pretty soon, or we're going to be in trouble. Because we know there's a lot of evidence that shows that the more antibiotic use in children, the more likely they are then to develop, you know, allergies and asthma and so on. So, you know, and often the things that we have antibiotics for, you know, like it's often ear infections and things like that in kids. A lot of the time they're actually viruses. They're caused by viruses. We're taking antibiotics and there's actually no benefit. And yet we're not really taking into account the fact that we may be putting our kids at risk later in life. I think that's something that, you know, we probably need to start thinking about seriously.
Yeah. Full disclosure, my wife is a GP. So she's a family doctor. And so she sees a lot of people with young kids and that sort of thing. And this exact thing that you're talking about happens all the time. And I think people come in to their doctors and they have, if they have a virus, really, my understanding, I don't know, is that all you can do is support the body to fight the virus. So you stay hydrated, you stay well rested, you eat the good foods, and just, you know, try to put as less strain on your body as possible.
Yeah, you have a couple of days of feeling pretty crap.
But when people
or your kid will feel crap.
Yeah. But when people go to the doctor, there's sort of this expectation that, you know, I've made the time and paid to make this appointment, so I'm going to walk out with something. Seems to have fueled the rise in overprescribing antibiotics, because I guess formerly they were seen as not having a huge detrimental effect. So doctors were just like, I can give you this, so it's not going to do any harm. And you feel like you're getting some value out of this meeting, so we'll just do that. Would you agree with that sort of?
Oh, I completely agree with that. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there really was a time when, you did expect to come out with a little parcel of something to make you feel better, whether it did or not. I mean, sometimes it does. Sometimes you have to take antibiotics, you know, and you should in certain cases. But again, it's about managing that a bit better, I think.
It seems like in the last five or maybe slightly longer, five-ish years, there's been a lot of things that we didn't know before about the importance of the microbiome and its impact, and particularly this kind of link between the gut and the stomach and the brain that we just had no idea about before from a scientific point of view. Can you speak to any of that research or those findings that have been coming out?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think in terms of the microbiome, you know, up to about like maybe 10, 15 years ago, we had no way of measuring it. So you can't know about something that you can't see or can't detect. So then when we did get those tools, you know, there's been this massive explosion of research and so much data, we're drowning in it. But, you know, out of that, you know, probably in the last maybe 5 years or so, we're kind of like coming to some consensus about various things. And one of those is the recognition of the gut-brain axis, which, I mean, I think, you know, that's been known about for a long time, that, you know, the gut does signal to the brain, you know, to stop eating its full, blah, blah, blah. But now we've got this extra layer of information really about the microbiome. And so it's more like a microbiome gut brain axis. So there's a lot of research being done in areas of neurological disorders and anxiety, depression, and there's very strong links with the gut microbiome and some really, really interesting research being done.
So there's actually there's this mountain of research now that we've got these tools to be able to measure what's going on in our guts at a microbial level, and it's suggesting that there's a huge link between these weird ill effects that we didn't know were related around like mood and depression and things to the microbiome, that forest that's happening in our guts. That's what the science is telling us at the moment?
Yeah, that's what the science is telling us.
If that's the case, like what are we doing wrong that's causing us to have these unhealthy microbiomes and these ill effects that happen as a result of that?
Well, I mean, the thing is, we're still at a very early stage in this. And a lot of the research that's been done is looking at the microbiome in a person in at one point in time. And we know that it fluctuates a lot. So really, you know, what we need is more data over long periods of time, which is happening, but we probably won't get the answers for a bit. And there's also huge differences between people. Like, everybody has an individual microbiome. That makes it really, really hard to kind of go, okay, that's bad, that's good. But we do know from, you know, there are some really good animal studies done where, you know, mice have been given the microbiome from people who've got major depressive disorder, and then the mice get depressed based on the microbiome. So this, that's actually quite amazing.
Transfer the germ forest that a depressed person's got into the body of a mouse, and so it flourishes in that kind of a similar form to what was in the host. And then they get depressed as well.
And they get the same traits from their donor.
Is that study how we have sort of seen that link between mood disorders?
That's like, these kind of studies have been very, very key. I mean, I think there's always been a feeling amongst quite, you know, some psychiatrists that there is quite a strong link, because, you know, you see things with IBS, which is very, very, you know, frequently seen, but probably about 20% of the population. And that's, you know, that whole anxiety linked disorder that really affects the gut. And you see it also in patients with PTSD, you know, they often get really bad gut disorders as well. So there's always been that kind of thought that there's something going on. But I think now we know more about the enteric nervous system, which is this massive nervous system that surrounds our gut.
What was that word again, sorry?
The what? Enteric.
Enteric.
Enteric. So it's like your second brain. So enteric just means your gut, but it's your enteric nervous system. So there's more nerves in that than there is in your spinal cord, believe it or not.
Wow.
So, you know, that's like really closely linked with your gut, and then that's communicating with your brain. So, yeah, it's like, yeah, it kind of makes sense if you think about it. You know, we talk about your gut feeling and, you know, the way you get butterflies in your tummy when you're nervous. You know, I mean, how is that? And it's like, it's the link between, you know, the different chemical products that the gut is breaking down and signaling through your neurons to your brain. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's really, really fascinating.
All of these old sayings and idioms that we've had, you know, the clues were there for centuries.
They were there. But we just, I think, particularly in medicine and biomedical science, we tend to kind of silo ourselves a little bit. Like, you know, if you're studying any kind of mood disorders, you're looking from the neck up. You're not looking down. And whereas now we're kind of starting to see a more systems biology approach, which is really, really important. And it's kind of taking people in from every field and taking a really big overview. And suddenly it's like, you know, you're taking the blinkers off and you're seeing new connections that we wouldn't have seen before.
Well, I'm keen to hear about what you're doing now, but maybe to set the scene for that, what exactly was your PhD in? What did you focus on?
Oh, it was nothing to do with this at all. It was in childhood liver cancer, actually, and looking at the genetics and the molecular mechanisms behind a type of liver tumor called hepatoblastoma that some babies are actually born with. So, yeah, that was quite different.
So, well, this is interesting, though, because so your focus has actually, you've come into this through the cancer angle and then found this connection to the microbiome through that.
Well, yeah, I was always interested in the microbiology and the microbiome ever since I did a master's. So I was kind of keeping an eye on the field. And then when I came back, I was working in France for a bit and came back to New Zealand and, you know, got a job in the Department of Surgery. And they're obviously very interested in colorectal cancer, but it was just that opportunity to kind of bring different fields together, really.
And it seems to me from the outside that the scientific community is sort of, there are links that are forming there between
I think we're definitely converging from different angles, which is great because you get different points of view as well. You know, you're more aware of things that you wouldn't have necessarily thought of. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
You were mentioning earlier that there's the phenomenon of having butterflies in your stomach and a weird feeling in your gut. Like, the whole name of this podcast is Gut Reactions for a reason. It's because you feel something in your gut. And we've kind of known about that feeling in a generalized way and talked about it for ages and ages. I'm quite interested in this link you mentioned before of irritable bowel syndromes and anxiety. I mean, I've even seen it in friends of mine who suffer from both of those types of disorders. Because I kind of thought, you know, if you had IBS, that could create some anxiety because you're constantly needing to know where a bathroom is at any given point. And it can be kind of limiting to your life. But could it in fact be the other way around, in that when you're anxious, what's the suspicion that you're producing some chemicals and hormones in your brain and that's affecting your gut microbiome makeup? Or...
Well, I mean, this isn't my field, to be honest, the whole gut-brain axis. But yeah, it's a very chicken and egg situation, and it's very hard to decipher that. But what they do know is that like very early childhood traumas have a big effect on, you know, later anxiety and things like IBS. So whether those traumas are just things that are psychological or maybe things like, you know, having too many antibiotics and actually impairing your microbiome. And they're things that people are currently looking at and following, you know, birth cohorts, you know, all the way through and sampling them. And yeah, so I think, you know, we will find out more, but at the moment we just don't have that information.
Wow. Even that suspicion though, that like psychological childhood trauma could have a similar effect to being over medicated like antibiotics. That seems pretty significant.
It's pretty huge. But I mean, it's also pretty cool because, I mean, you can't do much about your genetics, but we can manipulate our microbiomes and we can change things. So it also opens up the door to, you know, the question of, can we make our, you know, our mental health better by eating better, you know, by taking, you know, particular probiotics or prebiotics or manipulating our gut microbiome in some way. And there are trials going on at the moment, you know, with people with, say, depressive disorder, and, you know, some of them are being given particular diets, not instead of their treatment, but additive to their treatment, and looking to see if that actually helps improve their symptoms.
Wow.
But yeah, it's a really, really fascinating area. And I just think, yeah, watch this space for the next 5-10 years. There's going to be a lot of changes, I think.
What seems to be the way that you can, well, you can answer this one of two ways. What's really bad for your gut health? From what you could see, and what is good, like what are good practices, what are good things to do? Is diet the main thing? Are there other components that go into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that we have control over, yeah, we can say no to antibiotics unless it's actually a diagnosed bacterial infection. If it's suspicious of viral, just don't do it.
Because just to be clear, antibiotics have no effect if you've got a virus.
No, none at all. Yeah. Diet is a huge thing. It really is. And, you know, there's a lot of pretty good, strong evidence now that the more diverse your food is, the more diverse your microbiome is going to be as well. So you want to feed up those good, friendly bacteria as much as you can. So that really means trying to make a move towards a bit more of a plant-based diet, you know, bringing in lots of different types of fiber. It doesn't have to be just whole grains, but, you know, vegetables, fruit, and, you know, things like that as well. Fermented foods are shown to have a really good effect as well. And it doesn't have to be things like
all those claims about kombucha and stuff. There actually might be something to it.
There might be something to it. I know I'm not a massive fan, but hey, that's all right, you know. But, you know, it doesn't have to be like that. It could just be yogurt, something as simple as that, or sauerkraut, you know. But they definitely do feed up the bugs that we really want to have in our guts, because they produce these things called short-chain fatty acids. And we know that these are anti-inflammatory molecules, and that's good. We don't want inflammation.
Because inflammation is the cause of a lot of problems in the body, right?
Yeah.
It kind of comes out in a lot of different ways.
I mean, inflammation is good in certain circumstances. We need it to fight things. But when we have it chronically, so chronic inflammation.
What is it? Maybe talk about what is inflammation?
Inflammation it sets off something in the body that activates your immune cells to fight off pathogens or, you know, anything else that's an assault to our body, basically.
Right.
But then if it's uncontrolled, if it doesn't stop when we get rid of the pathogen and we have this low level chronic inflammation, it can cause really major effects to our whole bodies, really.
Wow. So it's basically the command to go sort something out. But if it gets overactivated, we have
issues. Yeah. It just doesn't get switched off. Yeah.
At the risk of lowering the tone, Rachel, could we talk about poo a little bit?
Oh yeah, let's do that.
Because it seems
like kids, we talk about poo all the time.
It seems like poo is quite important to this conversation. So from what I've been learning, the little bits I've been reading about from the Gut Foundation of New Zealand, poo's kind of critical to maybe diet, like self-diagnosing what's going on with your gut health. Is there a link there? Can we find out things about ourselves from our poo?
I'm probably not the expert in poo. I mean, you really want to look for changes in consistency in your poo. You know, you don't want stools that are too hard and painful to pass. You don't want any blood in your stools. They're all like signs that you really possibly should be going to see your doctor. Mm-hmm. If you're eating enough fiber, enough fruit and vegetables, like, you know, plant-based food, you'll have normal poo.
It's so funny when science catches up to, because, like, you know, my mum's been telling me to eat my greens since I was born, and it's like, here's the science to back up why that is so very critical.
Your mother was right. Your mother's always right.
Yeah, it's true. And this is a very specific thing that I wonder if you can talk about a little bit, but I can't remember the medical name, but these poo transplants, what's that all about?
Fecal microbiome transplants. Strangely enough, this has been going on for millennia, maybe.
Wow.
There's evidence that in China or in some Eastern countries that they used to actually do this to treat illnesses. But it hasn't really been in vogue for a while. And now it's really come back into fashion now that we know more about the microbiome.
What is it, first off?
What is it? Literally, it is taking a poo sample from a donor, a healthy donor that's been screened for anything that's pathogenic. So you don't want to actually give somebody, you know, an infection. Mm. And it is this fecal material is actually put up inside the colon of your recipient, who's usually had some kind of a gut washout, basically. And it's used really, really successfully to treat C. diff infections that don't respond to antibiotics. So C.
I want
diff
to be super clear really, here. We're taking poo from a healthy person.
Yeah.
We're putting it inside the body of another host person.
Yeah. But I'd say just don't try this at home.
Yeah.
And apparently people do.
Oh my God.
Yeah. There's a spike in sales of Nutribullets after this kind of like hit the headlines first. So
what? Nutribullets?
Yeah. Not in New Zealand, in the States. Yeah.
I've got a Nutribullet. That is not what they are designed for.
Well, you never know.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so sorry. This is a practice that there is some evidence that's been going on for thousands of years. And
they used to call it yellow soup, and that was transplanted into people who were, I don't know, had some kind of illnesses, presumably infections, and it was used as a treatment. Yeah.
And it's coming back into vogue now.
Yeah, I mean, in modern times, it's actually used quite extensively in the States and Canada for particular treatment of this infection with this one bug that really takes over and gives really bad diarrhea. It can be life-threatening in kids, often doesn't respond to antibiotics. So they're given fecal microbiome transplants from a screened healthy donor, and often, very often the case, they recover.
Wow. Yeah.
Quite amazing.
That's incredible. Yeah.
But the thing is that's in one specific case where there's like one bad bacteria taking over. So it has been trialed in things like IBD and to varying levels of success.
Is IBD irritable bowel disorder?
Irritable bowel disease. So that's right. Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. But because they're not just caused by one bacteria, like we have in the C. diff infection, we're not really seeing the same results. There have been some cases where it's been successful and then others where it hasn't. So there's still a lot to be learned, I think.
Right. And so what is the research that you are doing right now?
I'm doing a range of research projects, really, that all relate to the gut and different gut diseases. Probably the biggest ones are in colorectal cancer. So we're looking at different types of colorectal cancers. So you can get, they're not all the same. They don't all act the same. They don't have the same kind of disease course or even respond the same to different types of therapy. So we're trying to understand how the microbiome is actually how it plays a role at the start of the disease process in colorectal cancer, and maybe pushes it up one subtype pathway compared to another, and you know, is that caused by a difference in the microbiome? And because that will really have an effect on treatment options later on, because you might have heard of immunotherapy. It's kind of a fairly newish therapy on the block that's, you know, very, very promising, but it doesn't work very well in colorectal cancer at all. It only works in a very, very small percentage. So we're looking at how differences in the tumor microbiome might actually affect how immunotherapy might work, with a view to actually changing people's microbiome to make it more effective. It's actually not available in New Zealand anyway,
right,
for colorectal cancer, but this is kind of like a big kind of project that we're looking at.
In colorectal cancer is like particularly aggressive, right? Is it quite a nasty form?
It depends on when it's caught. If you catch it early, you've got a very, very good chance of full recovery with just surgery if it's an early stage tumor. If it's late stage and it's already metastasized, I mean spread to another organ, your options are kind of limited, really, treatment wise.
Who's most at risk of these sorts of cancers?
Well, I would have always said that it was a disease of elderly people, but now we're seeing it on the rise in younger people.
Wow.
Under the age of 50, particularly in New Zealand.
It's going up, and that's not just a diagnosis thing where it's like we're screening for it more. There seems to be like it's actually increasing.
But people under 50 aren't in the screening group.
Right.
Yeah, so we are probably catching more cases and early stage tumors, and that means we're treating them and people are actually having better outcomes overall. And probably because of the screening, you know, we're going to see a decrease overall. But there's this really worrying young group where it's on the increase. So yeah, that's something that we're looking into as well.
Any suspicions about why it's going up for that group?
Why it's going up in young people?
Yeah.
Well, it's not genetics, because you can't change your genetics that fast. I mean, this is compared to say like in the 1980s. It has to be something in the environment, and probably the most obvious thing really is your microbiome, which is, you know, reacting to the kind of diet that we have in the last 50 years and how much that's changed.
I remember from a few years ago, there was some news stories that came out about this mini epidemic of mothers in Britain in particular who got incredibly anxious and like scrubbed everything in their house and didn't allow their children to kind of go outside enough and be exposed to germs and dirt. And they had quite terrible health outcomes later on, and quite severe, like asthma and eczema and that sort of thing.
Allergies, yeah.
So this is sort of maybe linked into that basket as well. Possibly?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We just don't know, because things like colorectal cancer, they grow slowly over time. So unless we were actually following people, you know, and taking the right types of samples, which of course we weren't, we are now, but it'll be, you know, it'll take a while before we actually have the answers to that.
So based on what we know right now, what's our best shot of doing good things for our gut? And I guess we've already sort of mentioned it a little bit, but like...
We've mentioned the diet. Yeah. And probably in terms of the diet as well, avoiding processed food. Yeah, processed food isn't great for your microbiome. It doesn't like it. You're not doing it any favors. But, you know, other things, other lifestyle changes are kind of important as well. Like there's some really good studies linking exercise to a healthy microbiome. And when I say healthy, I mean... It's very hard to tell exactly what a healthy microbiome looks like, because we're all different and we can all be healthy or unhealthy, but we know that diversity is a really good measure. So that's what I talk about when I say healthy.
Comes back ownership. To that forest metaphor. We can't just grow
back to the forest. Yeah,
we can't just grow pine trees. Yeah.
Trees are pine trees either. Owning a pet is a really good thing to do.
Oh, really?
It's associated with a much more diverse microbiome. Getting good sleep. There's some pretty strong evidence about your circadian rhythm and the effects on the microbiome. So it's kind of all the things that you kind of know deep down that you should be doing: eating well, sleeping well,
having a dog,
trying to avoid stress, and having a dog. So it's really about, I think some of it is about even just being aware that you have a microbiome. might make you think twice about your diet choices, you know? So I think education is probably an important thing.
So what I'm hearing from this is I should avoid staying up all night and just hammering pizza for nights.
Exactly.
On okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Occasionally, do it occasionally, but not every night.
Fair enough. Well, super interesting research that you're engaged in, and this whole field is quite mind-blowing in terms of what the science is starting to suggest is quite life-changing for all people. Like if the effects are as broad and important as we think they are in terms of that gut-brain connection and how much microbiome can affect even our mood, as well as these disorders from like potentially cancers to IBS and that. This is big, important stuff that we seem like we're on the verge of.
Yeah, I think it really is. And I think a lot more research needs to be done. And there's always the risk of overhyping things and, you know, you already see it, like companies jumping on the word microbiome and trying to sell stuff before we actually know what's going on. But I mean, I think there is so much investment in research in the microbiome field that we are going to see some really positive, cool stuff coming out of this soon in terms of, you know, changes that we can make to make ourselves healthier and better treatments. And yeah, I think it's a really, really fascinating area.
Well, for the good of us all, please keep doing what you're doing, Dr. Rachel Purcell. We need your research.
Thanks, Tim. Oh, I'll keep going.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it, Rachel.
Okay, thanks, Tim.